Welcome to Call Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. This week, another chance for you, our loyal podcast listeners, to ask questions of me and our brilliant Serious Eats Food Lab columnist and best-selling New York Times author, Kenji Lopez Ault. Our motto is, what Kenji cannot answer is probably unknowable, though I will not resist throwing in my two spoonsful just to throw them off balance. Today we're talking turkey because it's Thanksgiving and everyone always has a zillion questions. And also today, Kenji and I are in the same place. We're in the same city. Welcome, Kenji, to New York City and our beloved studio.
Thanks, Ed.
What you been doing, man, in New York?
What have I been doing?
Yeah.
I was emceeing the Star Chefs International Convention yesterday.
And so were you—
long, interesting show, but also, well, long. Long is one of the words.
And were there mostly chefs peppering you with questions, or were you just moderating?
I was moderating. So, I was just introducing the chefs who were doing demos. A bunch of really great chefs, actually, from around the world. It was really interesting.
And do chefs universally appreciate your point of view because you have spent time in restaurant kitchens, or is there a little bit of resentment, like, why is this guy telling so many things?
I don't know. You know, I sometimes feel out of place at these events because chefs are at restaurants and restaurants are a different world, and I haven't been in restaurants for probably a decade now. I always feel like they're the serious ones, and I'm like just this guy who writes for Home Cooks, and so and maybe it's all in my head, but I do feel like I don't get taken as seriously, but I think I'm probably just imagining it.
That's great.
I mean, there were plenty of people who came up and said, you know, they knew my work and liked it and all that stuff.
Yeah, so, which is very unusual because most cookbook authors are sort of put in a different basket by chefs. Like, oh, they're cookbook authors, and then they're chefs.
Yeah, yeah.
And you sort of straddle the line in an unusual way. Well, many of you have already emailed questions to specialsauce@serioseats.com. We welcome them anytime you happen to be listening. But, Kenji, it's time for our first caller, John in Chicago. How you doing, John?
Hi, Ed.
You are lucky enough to be talking to Kenji and me about Thanksgiving because we have covered so many things on Thanksgiving when it comes to cooking, preparing, serving.
Thanksgiving is our most popular, busiest time of the year.
Right.
I think probably for most food sites.
Yeah.
There's so much fear around Thanksgiving. It's really bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, because it's throwing people into a different situation. Like, it's very rare. Usually it's the only time of year that somebody is going to be cooking for a large group of people and has all these different dishes to manage. So it's throwing people into a completely different situation. And that's what gets people scared.
So what really seems weird to me is that people are freaked out about the bird. The bird is the easiest thing in the world.
Well, once you have a thermometer, true.
Yeah, a thermometer and a baster. You know, that's all you need.
I don't know. We have to talk to Kenji about basters. But what's your question about birds then?
I see that, like, at Target and Kroger, you can get turkey, you see, butterballs for 99 cents a pound. So my wife said, well, it's time to get our turkey ordered. We have fancy relatives coming to town, you know. So I said, sure, I mean, let's just get a butterball. She's like, no. Got to go to the bourgeois food co-op.
Right.
And order a non-GMO.
Oh, I know that place.
That's a chain, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In Tony suburbs like Oak Park, Illinois, you can spend a lot of money on a bird. But anyway, so I said, no, 99 cents, a butterball is fine. You defrost it, it's delicious. Well, so I dutifully trudged down after she browbeat me. And I found, there were three different fresh turkeys, never mm-hmm. frozen, that I could order in advance.
Okay.
One was $2.79
okay.
a pound.
And what were they calling that one?
Well, they were calling that pasture-raised.
Okay.
With no antibiotics. And then the $3.79 was free-range, cage-free, non-GMO. No antibiotics. And then the $6.59, get that price per pound.
Yeah.
You know, there was a long list. I'm not sure if they named the turkeys, like in Portlandia.
That was like a heritage bird of some kind, right?
Yeah, exactly. $6.59. So I, of course, went with the non-organic pasture raised at $2.79. But, you know, I paid three times what I could have paid at Target. And my question for Kenji is, am I a punk, you know, for giving in?
Well, it all depends on what you're on what you want, you know. I think there when people are buying a turkey, there's usually I think three different things to take into account. So there's going to be the flavor of the turkey, right? So the flavor and the juiciness. Then there's going to be the difficulty in preparing it, because some types of, I think, you know, heritage birds are a little harder to prepare properly than a butterball. And then finally, the sort of ethical and environmental standards by which it's raised. And of course, you know, where you fall on those three things is a totally personal decision. Some people will make you think that the latter one is not a personal decision and it's a universal truth. But, you know, I think for most people, it is a personal decision. You have to decide where you fall on that spectrum. But, you know, as far as flavor goes, I mean, that's a pretty easy one, actually. So a butterball turkey is what we call an enhanced bird. So it's self-basting, which means that it's been injected with a saltwater brine, pre-injected with a brine. And so a butterball, and the reason that they do that is so that it's almost impossible to overcook. You can cook it to 180 degrees and you slice it open and it's still going to be glistening with moisture because it's all sort of liquid that's been added in. But what you'll find in taste tests, and these are taste tests that I've done and many other publications have done, what you find is that those turkeys, they're so watery and they're very watery, and thus they taste watered down as well. So they'll be really juicy, but they won't have very good flavor.
Right.
On the other hand, a pasture-raised turkey or a free-range turkey, something that is spending a lot more time outdoors, probably has a more varied diet, gets a little more exercise. That's a turkey that's probably going to have a little bit more flavor because, you know, the more exercise you do, the tastier you become.
That's true for humans too.
It is true. Yeah. So when the aliens come, when the aliens come down and start throwing us into ovens, the ones who exercise the most are going
exactly.
to be the first to go.
I am in big trouble because I work out a lot.
With all the spinning courses you do, Ed, you'll be really tasty. Now that's what they said to me. They said, you know, that the color and taste of the bird because it was pasture raised.
Right.
That's the big difference.
And that sounds like
they're getting muscle movement, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, and that sounds like it could just be good marketing, but you'll find in taste test after taste test that's actually true. And then finally, you know, once you get down to your 659 turkey, your heritage bird.
Get up
to 659, yeah. You will actually find even a bigger flavor difference. Maybe a bigger flavor difference between a butterball and your pasture, but then you will find, you know, incremental improvement in flavor because, you know, heritage beef. So modern turkeys are bred. If the turkey industry could engineer it, your turkey would be like a perfect sphere of breast meat because that's what people want. They want, it's at least what most people want. They want just that big fat slice
like
of breast meat. Yeah.
Right.
So heritage birds tend to have much leaner breasts because they're breeds of turkeys that have been around before we started doing this, before we started breeding them to have bigger and bigger breasts and blander meat. So heritage birds tend to have thinner breasts, but a lot more concentrated flavor, and the same in their legs. It's just going to be it will be a tastier bird. Of course, though, you know, once we get down to it, those birds become increasingly difficult to cook well. So a butterball, you can't mess it up. You know, my mother could take a butterball and it'll come out juicy. And believe me, my mom, I love my mom, but she's not the best cook. But a heritage breed bird, you have to be very, very careful about it because it's going to be leaner, it's going to be smaller, it'll be tougher. You have to be very, very careful about monitoring temperature and really cooking it nice and gently so that it'll come out juicy at the end. So those are sort of two considerations. On the one hand, yes, better flavor. On the other hand, more difficulty. So you run a bigger risk of overcooking and drying it out.
I think I made the right call. It's a low cost, you know, but it did have the pasture raised, and I think that's probably most important. Somebody told me once that you should put aluminum foil over the bird at first to keep it from drying out, or just over the top over the breast part, and that at the end, like the last half hour, you can take it off to get it to brown. How do you feel about that controversy? That earth-shaking controversy.
whether to put a foil hat on your turkey or not?
Yeah.
Well, so the reason you would want to put foil over a turkey breast, and this is assuming that you're cooking your turkey in a sort of traditional way where it's still roughly the same shape that it was when it was alive, minus the head. So your turkey, your breasts are kind of facing up. They're very exposed to the heat of the oven. And meanwhile, your legs are kind of tucked underneath and they're more protected. Turkey meat, so leg meat and breast meat, you want them to actually cook to two different final temperatures. Leg meat, you want it to get to at least 165 degrees, probably more like 170, 175, and that's when it's going to start to become sort of tender and juicy and tasty. If you were to cook a turkey breast all the way to 175 degrees, unless it's a butterball, it's going to be completely dry. You really want to keep your chicken breast meat, turkey breast meat, or chicken actually, same temperature for both, your breast meat down to around 150 degrees or so. That's one of the reasons why you might want to add foil, because it will act as a shield for the heat, so it'll help the breast cook a little more gently at the beginning than the leg meat will. And there's all kinds of tricks to help make that happen. In the print magazine industry, which I used to be in, we ran into this problem every November, is that each year we need a new, fantastic, best ever turkey recipe.
Right.
Yeah. It's turkey every year, and you can't repeat yourself. In web publication, we're much luckier. We found a couple of techniques we really like, and we can promote them again every year at Thanksgiving, because turkey technology has not changed that much in the last year. But in print publications, you always had to find a new thing. So usually that meant like finding a new creative way to keep the breast meat from overcooking. So it could have been foil one year. Then the next year maybe it was, cooking the turkey with the breast meat upside down.
What about the oiled paper bag? Did you ever hear that?
I've never heard of the oiled paper bag. Is this a Levine family secret?
No, our producer said that his family's been using it for years, and his mom is like 98.
Okay.
So, but she continues the dry white meat tradition.
Right.
So
it's important to keep traditions. The most elaborate one, the most elaborate version was one year we did a recipe, a colleague of mine did a recipe for turkey where you start by taping together 2-gallon-sized Ziploc bags at the seams and filling them with ice and then draping it over the turkey breast. Kind of like one of those ice sleep masks that you put over your face?
Yes. This sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit.
You drape it over the turkey breast to deep chill it so that you can throw the whole thing in the oven, and that way the breast meat doesn't cook quite as fast. The technique we use at Serious Eats, if we want a whole turkey presented spatchcocking is our favorite thing to do. But if you want to have the whole turkey, our trick is to actually use either a baking steel or a baking stone. So you preheat that in the oven, and then instead of like a heavy stainless steel roasting pan, you use a thin aluminum rimmed baking sheet with a rack set in it. You put your turkey on there, preheat your baking steel or baking stone in the oven, and then place the turkey directly on top of that. And what happens is that the energy stored in that stone, just like if you're cooking a pizza, the energy stored in that stone is going to help the bottom of the pizza to crisp up and heat fast. What it does is it helps the bottom of the turkey, where the legs are, heat faster. And that way, your entire turkey ends up finishing cooking at about the same time because the legs are getting that jump start. I find it's a lot easier than taping ice bags to your turkey breast.
Yeah.
All right, John, I hope we've settled everything between you and your wife concerning your Thanksgiving bird.
You have, and I'm going to tell her that I'm going to spatchcock her.
Exactly.
The night before.
All right, thanks a lot, man. Thanks for calling.
You guys. All right. Bye.
So, Kedgy, we have a Thanksgiving call. Aaron, what's up, Aaron?
It's different for me. I'm a catering chef. Yeah, we sort of surf another wave beside the restaurant chefs and the home cooks.
I did a little bit of catering before, but and some personal chef. I think personal chefs and caterers kind of fall into the same category, and I think both of them are kind of often derided by real, like quote unquote real chefs.
Right. You're at the, you both are at the personal chefs and caterers are thought of to be at the bottom of the chef's food chain.
It's true, but they have to do that so that they make sure that they feel good because they haven't seen their family in like right. 2 years.
Personal, yeah, caterers are the smart ones. I think they're the ones who have the nights off.
Yeah. It comes in waves for us here and there. Then for those guys, it's like, you know, full on all the time, never out of that.
Yeah, for chefs, it's, yeah, whatever they can do to make themselves feel better.
Yeah, I support that. They're out there fighting for us, you know, innovating, doing their thing.
So what's your question, Aaron? You must cater lots of Thanksgiving things and also grown up with many Thanksgiving traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be honest, like we haven't done as many Thanksgiving things, like, you know, as we were just discussing, that's one of the times I usually choose to be like, that's the one holy holiday for family that we go. That's the one, the required attendance in my family. So, but we are doing a couple things this year. And I guess the biggest question, well, sort of the main one I had is like, there's this holy place of the like big bird on the table.
Right.
That even though we, you know, especially Serious Eats readers know that like breaking it apart, doing them separately, splitting up is the way to go. But when people want that, like, holy big bird, but you have to pack it up into, like, and then carry it someplace and then re-put it and have it be crispy and perfect.
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up, Aaron, because I've actually done that where I bring the turkey in a non-catering setting just to a potluck turkey dinner. And I have never, I failed. I failed miserably.
You never have crispy skin.
I never have crispy skin. I can never figure it out. Sometimes I go through the broiler and then the skin burns and then I'm screwed.
You're roasting the entire turkey in one location. You're wrapping it up hot. Is that right? Or are you
cooling
it?
Well, no. I mean, I let it cool to, you know, to a certain, but it'll be that same day. You know, trying to you know, not leave it out at room temperature all day.
I certainly
don't want to bring it down cold. So I try to surf the difference. You know what I mean? Like, you will get rid of it that day. Yeah, I'm not going to wrap it up super hot, but...
Do caterers have to get checked by health inspectors?
Well, you know, again, another gray area. But yeah, our kitchens certainly do, but I think everybody conveniently ignores, like, a lot of factors.
So then when you bring it to the actual location you're serving it, you're reheating it there. There's going to be an oven there and you're reheating
it. Oh, yeah.
Got it. Okay. And how do you typically roast your turkeys?
I don't know. I mean,
like, salt and pepper, obviously. Do you
salt
do
and
like
pepper, slow and low?
Do you do butter or oil or anything on the skin like that, or just au naturel?
Usually au naturel. Would you recommend butter or oil?
Well, it really depends on what you want. Oil can help distribute heat more evenly, which can give you sort of a more even browning, like a sort of bronzed look to it. And butter, you know, butter has water in it and it has some milk solids. So it'll give you kind of a splotchier look, but a lot of people like that flavor of the butter. Although this is all kind of neither here nor there because it doesn't get to the root of the crispiness problem.
I think you're not sure you can get them the crispy skin, are you?
I think we might be able to get there. Given that there's an oven on location, that's going to help with a lot of things. So your clients, they have their hearts set on the whole bird, right? You can't, for instance, take off the skin, cook it separately to crisp it, and then serve the meat and the skin, side by side at the
table. Peking duck style.
Sort of Peking duck style, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll say this, that if I went back to my clients and I told them that Serious Eats personally told me that this was the way to go, I think they might be convinced. but they did ask for the whole bird, yeah.
And you can't have one, like, a show bird, like an inflatable bird you put on the table and then you have the real meat back in the kitchen.
Yeah, I still want to do that, actually. I really do. So can you talk me through if I were to take it apart, like, what is the process there of splitting the skin separately? How would I do that?
Okay, well, I mean, you're a caterer, and I assume you're kind of up to date with sort of more modern techniques, so you probably have, like a sous vide circulator or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it was another question I wanted to ask you is, like, have you done, say, straight up, like, I don't know, like a...
A whole sous vide like turkey?
No, I wouldn't do it whole, but like a turkey leg confit or something like that, and how that turns out.
Yeah, that turns out great. That's actually what I would do. I would separate the turkey. So I would have the legs in one. I would cook the legs one way. I would cook breasts without the skin another way, and then I would cook the skin completely separately from it. So what I would do with the legs, I'd probably do it confit style. So in a bag with some aromatics, salted overnight, or even a couple nights, and then in a bag with maybe some duck fat or olive oil or you know, whatever kind of fat that you want to use in there. Low and slow sous vide until it's sort of fall apart tender. And that, you know, that'll be your leg meat. And then the breasts, I would roll the two breast halves together, take them off the bone, roll the two breast halves together sort of into a roulade. Ed, you've been to, you know, Teresi, right?
Yeah.
Or Parm.
Parm. Yeah. The famous turkey.
Yeah. So what they do is they season the turkey breast and they have the two breast halves kind of rolled together into a single, like roulade type thing, cook it sous vide and then slice it.
So can you give a sort of concise 30-second explanation of sous vide?
Yeah. So sous vide cooking, it started in the 70s in France, but became much more popular in the last, you know, decade or so. And only in the last couple of years for home cooks because devices used to cost thousands of dollars and now they're a couple hundred dollars. But sous vide, the idea is that you place food, generally meat, not always meat, but usually meat in a plastic bag. You take all the air out of the bag and seal it, and that's where the sous vide comes from. It means under vacuum. So you vacuum seal the food, and then you put it into a water bath that's held at a very precise temperature. So most sous vide machines will hold it within plus or minus, you know, 0.1 degrees of what you set it to. And the idea is that you're cooking the meat at the final temperature, generally at the final temperature that you want to serve it. A turkey breast would be about 150 degrees or so. That's what I would do. And so when you put it in there, it takes a long time for it to come up to 150 degrees through and through. But what you end up with is a piece of meat that's cooked perfectly evenly from edge to center. So much sort of juicier end results, you know, because when you cook traditionally, you're roasting your turkey at a much higher temperature. And so what you end up with is sort of this temperature gradient where the center might be 150 degrees, but it gets warmer and warmer as you get to the outside. So the outer layers kind of end up drying out.
You know what I do is I take a page out of your book and I spatchcock the turkey and then I cook it breast side down so all the juice goes into the white meat rather than out of the white meat.
Is this a page for my book?
No, it's just the idea of spatchcocking.
Yeah, spatchcocking. The idea of juices flowing down via gravity is
a wives tale?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, a turkey is not a sponge. It's not a water balloon.
I thought that made so much sense for so long.
Right. Oh, but Aaron, we didn't get to the important part, which is the skin.
Yes, that's the part that I that's the tricky part.
What I would do, and this is again assuming that they don't care about the you know, having the whole bird presentation, is I would take the skin completely off the turkey, and then I would spread it out on a rim baking sheet lined with parchment paper. Season it with salt and pepper. Place another sheet of parchment paper on top and kind of smooth it out. And then place a second rim baking sheet on top of that, and then roast that in the oven.
It
cooks sort of like, you know, sort of like cooking bacon in a pan. It'll get really crispy on its own, and then once it's crispy, because there's no meat underneath it that's going to start delivering moisture to it, it'll actually stay. You can leave it at room temperature for, you know, overnight even, and the next day it'll still be completely crispy. And then all you have to do is heat it up a little bit in the oven. So, you know, so that way you get, you know, it's a much more sort of, I guess, modern deconstructed presentation. So you get a little bit of the confit leg, a little like a slice of the breast roulade, and then some of the crispy skin to go with that.
And it's also people don't have to rip it off. You know, they don't have to rip things off the bird. You know, they don't have to destroy the bird when they're trying to eat it. I actually think people wouldn't mind this because I know at my house people come in and they admire the whole bird, but they never see it on the table. Right, they come into the kitchen. They say, "Wow, that looks beautiful," and that's the end of it.
We do whole bird on the table. I think at my family we do whole bird on the table, but maybe only because my mom's kitchen is so small.
You know, I have seen you use torches on many different occasions in the kitchen. Could you use a torch to crisp the skin?
Not really. You know, a torch, torches are fun to play with. They're good for adding sort of char, good for things like creme brulee. They're not that great at crisping skin. The problem is they're actually too intense. And skin burns so easily, and skin has such an uneven texture. So, you know what the inverse square law is?
No, no idea.
It's a sort of basic principle of physics. So the inverse square law it refers to the decay of the way heat spreads out, or the way light spreads out, or even the way like a smell would spread out in three-dimensional space. And the basic idea is that as you move further, so if there's a source of heat. Let's say a point source of heat, as you move away from it, the intensity of that heat, so the distance you go, let's call that x, the intensity of the heat is going to be 1 over x squared. So that means as you it exponentially falls, exponentially gets lower as you move away from it. And so what that means is that if you're holding your torch, say, 2 inches away, not very far away, you have an incredibly intense heat. Even a very minor variation in the distance that of the turkey skin, so like say like a little dip or a little dimple that's sticking out, a thing that's sticking out a tiny bit is going to cook a lot faster than the part that's a little bit more recessed than that. And so what you end up with is a turkey that is charred in spots. So every little lump will become charred, and all the valleys will stay soft. In some cases, you want something like that. So for example, if you think about Neapolitan pizza.
Sure.
Right? You get those really dark spots, and then you get the really pale stuff underneath. And that's the same sort of principle, but you don't want your turkey skin looking like that.
Got it. Well, I hope we've answered your question, Aaron. Thank you so much for calling Call Special Sauce.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Aaron.
We've got our next caller. Hello, show. You're on Call Special Sauce.
Hello.
How's it going?
Wonderful to be here.
What's your question, Joe?
I guess I wanted to know what you serious eaters do when you have to go to a Thanksgiving dinner where, say, either the cook's in charge or the people bringing stuff are going to bring, I guess, not the best food, you know? So, how do you handle that? Do you like help them? Do you try to point out the errors of their ways? Or do you try to be as diplomatic as possible and push your food around on the plate?
I mean, when you're talking about bad food, do you mean like they overcooked the turkey, or do you mean that they just have terrible taste and they made like a hash brown casserole with potato chip topping and marshmallows on everything?
I mean, either one of those, but I mean, those are like would be kind of common, I guess. I guess from my own personal experience, I've been to family Thanksgivings where somebody was like, let's say this actually happened. Somebody was supposed to bring the mashed potatoes, but instead of bringing mashed potatoes, they brought refrigerated boiled cubed potatoes, which they then tried to
mash,
which they then tried to put through a food mill and turn into mashed potatoes. And I was just looking at it and I was like, there's just no way this is going to work.
And did it work? Or?
I know that they struggled with it, and I did try a little bit of it, but it was just kind of, I mean, it's like terrible, you know? but I didn't say anything.
So no extra butter or cream or anything?
Oh, no, they did all this stuff.
Oh, okay.
It just, like, from my understanding of the science of it, it was just simply like, once you refrigerate it, they're going to get mealy. And then also trying to mash cold potatoes. And I was just kind of like, what do I do to fix the situation? The only thing I could think of was just shut up and, you know, eat the... Or pretend to eat it.
Yeah, I mean, shut up and eat is generally a pretty good strategy at family gatherings.
I guess it all depends on the nature of your relationship with your family. You know, in my case, you know, we shut up and eat, but we seethe inside.
So you have a very passive aggressive relationship with Thanksgiving,
right? But which I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, I mean, my family is just more aggressive aggressive.
So yeah, what can you do, Kenji? Though, if it's a potluck Thanksgiving and people they're just not up to making a dish that would be anywhere close to your standards, do you just shut up and eat?
No, I do. You know, Marty, our producer, was saying earlier that his mother likes to keep Thanksgiving traditions, and one of her traditions is serving dry turkey year after year. That was a tradition in my household, too. My mom made the turkey, and It was never good. It was dry, you know, and I'm sure a lot of us grew up with that, really dry turkeys. My mother also did the cold mashed potato thing, she wouldn't even bother reheating. She would make it either the day before or maybe the morning of, put them in a bowl, and then that was it. Wow. They would come straight to the table kind of lukewarm or maybe sometimes even cold. But I think the answer is yes, you shut up and eat. You know, I don't know, at least for me, like, one of my golden rules, and you know, these types of situations come up often. It'll be at holidays, and then very often at cookouts also, where the cook is probably out of their element. Even if they're a good cook, even if they're a good home cook, you know, 364 other days of the year when they're just cooking a smaller meal for a reasonable number of people, on Thanksgiving, you know, and when you're cooking out, the cook is out of their element. So you can't always blame them for. Sure. For not making things perfectly. So
it's a when bad things happen to good cooks moment.
Yeah. You're when a good cook is placed in an unfamiliar situation. But, you know, for me, the basic golden rule is like, don't insult the person who's holding the knife.
That's a very good rule. What about this thing? I don't know if this happens to you, Sho and Kenji. What about this thing of like, whenever somebody brings something, they always want their contribution to be acknowledged as special. So it's like, you know, have you guys tried my rum-soaked sweet potatoes with clarified butter? You know, it's like, and then you feel like they're practically demanding a critical response.
I feel like in that situation, that's when you come up with the spontaneous dietary restriction.
Wait, so Sho, sorry, how do you pronounce your last name?
Spaeth.
Spaeth. So can you tell us about the Spaeth family Thanksgiving growing up?
Well, actually, you know, that's sort of an odd thing because I actually grew up abroad. So I grew up in India. Our Thanksgivings, largely, we avoided turkey. We ended up doing often beef just because beef was so special. So any special occasion that came in, we'd do like a filet or something like that. And, you know, I mean, like we had mashed potatoes and we'd have some like roasted vegetables, but nothing like – that's why when I moved to the States and I visit my family, do my family's Thanksgiving in the States, it's very traditional, I guess, like – although I don't think I've ever eaten the green bean casserole, whatever that is.
I like green bean casserole. I even like the kind made with condensed cream and mushroom soup.
And those canned fried onions.
To me, and like, you know, a combination of like American ingenuity and also appalling factory kind of stuff. I don't know. Like, I mean, it sounds like, you know, one of the things actually I was introduced to when when I married my wife was her.
And your
mother,
wife is American?
Yes, my mother-in-law had stovetop, what's it called, stuffing?
Yeah. My mom made that all the time, which I actually really loved.
No, I really love it, too. It's, like, both appalling and delicious.
Yeah,
but, and actually, now I request it. They're trying to, like, scale up or, like, fancy up their Thanksgiving nowadays, and I still request it.
But I love, in general, I love the combination of appalling and delicious.
Do you drink at Thanksgiving? I don't know.
Oh, I drink heavily.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that helps, I think. You know, a little extra lubrication at the beginning helps the whole thing, helps everything go down more smoothly later on.
But I was just thinking with both of you having, like, high, you know, like, pretty high profile in the food world, like, wouldn't the people who invite you to their Thanksgivings or their Friendsgivings, they'd be like, well, these guys know their food, so what do? You know, you can't make the food better at the moment, but, like, for an example from my own family, it's like, one time, somebody was bold enough to suggest that they get something other than the supermarket frozen turkey. And, you know, the next Thanksgiving, somebody bought it, and it was, I mean, it was still dry, but it was at least interesting.
Had a little more flavor to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I think, in your question, that Thanksgiving food tends to be really sweet for you as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like the dried fruit thing. I don't know.
Got it. The dried fruit thing. So that's like in the stuffing, you mean?
Or... God, I feel like some Thanksgiving dinners, the dried fruit's in everything.
But you mean, well, it's in the stuffing. It can be, and obviously cranberry sauce is sweet.
Cranberry sauce is sweet, yeah. Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. There are marshmallows.
Oh, man.
You know, Sho does have a point.
Some things can be sweet, yeah, overly sweet. But, you know, getting back to your question, though, you know, Ed and I write about food for a living and often have to taste food critically for a living. But for me, you know, my work hat is different from my dining with friends or dining with family hat.
And people don't understand. I couldn't agree with you more.
And people tell me this, that they're afraid to invite me over to dinner because they're afraid that I'm going to judge their cooking or judge their taste. And it's like, that's not what a meal is about, right? Like that, maybe that's what it's about if you're talking about, you know, paying money at a restaurant and you have a certain expectation from this chef or that chef. But
yeah, it's a social thing.
Yeah, you know, and people actually ask me this a lot also, like, do you ever screw up when you're cooking? And it's like, yeah, all the time. And they're like, what do you do when you screw up? Do you serve it anyway? Well, I try and rescue it as best I can, but, you know, I've definitely served, like, overcooked things to friends. I've served things that were under or over-seasoned. And, you know, my philosophy there is like, well, you're inviting your friends and family over to your place for dinner, or conversely, you're going over to their place. And that's really the point of the meal, right? And particularly with Thanksgiving, the point of a Thanksgiving dinner is not really the turkey, right? The point of the Thanksgiving dinner is to get your friends and your family all around one table, hopefully enjoying each other's company. So once you have your whole family gathered around the table, the food has basically already done its job. You know, it doesn't really matter that much if it tastes great or if it tastes bad, you know, because it's done its job of getting people together.
And people, I don't think, you know, my wife says the same thing about people are intimidated by you and they don't, you know, that's why we don't get invited to dinner. And then, of course, I always say maybe they just don't like me, you know, but it is. I agree with Kenji. It's like I take off that hat when I'm at somebody's house for dinner. I may say to my wife, well, when she says, well, what'd you think when we're going home? But when we're there, I'm not there to be a food critic.
Right. You know, the one thing I do is I'll usually offer to help in the kitchen. So I'll try and keep my help. You don't want to take over someone's kitchen, but you can always offer to be, you know, the sous chef. You can say what needs chopping, what can I do to help? And then from there, maybe you can influence the end results a little bit. But, you know, you don't want to make someone feel uncomfortable in their own kitchen and definitely not in their own home. So, you know, I'd say maybe it's a kind of hard pill to swallow or a dried turkey breast to swallow.
Yes, exactly.
But now, sometimes you just got to put up with bad food for the greater good.
Well, exactly.
I mean, you did offer a different solution, which is you could just bring a salt shaker of MSG along.
That's funny. But you brought up that you grew up in eating turkeyless Thanksgivings.
Yes.
Kenji, what is your point of view about turkeyless Thanksgivings? I don't care.
About turkey.
Yeah, I mean, I cook it because people expect it, but I would be happy. I'm an adherent of the Calvin Trillin. You know, he once wrote a piece where he said that spaghetti carbonara was actually the first thing, was actually the dish that the pilgrims cooked at Thanksgiving.
I'm one of those maybe rare people who actually really likes turkey. Like I would have turkey multiple times a year, if it were normal and acceptable and available. But turkey's a little bit of a pain to cook and it's usually actually pretty difficult to find outside of the season. But no, I really love turkey. So I enjoy having the turkey at Thanksgiving. It wouldn't be Thanksgiving.
It wouldn't
turkey
be
for me.
Well, I've written about an all pie Thanksgiving.
Right.
You know, and
we made a turkey pie for it.
Yeah, and Kenji made an awesome turkey pie for it, which was a savory pie. But so I could eat an all pie Thanksgiving. I might be able to do with a few good pizzas and a salad and some fresh mozzarella from DiPaolo, like a nice antipasto.
So you'd be happy if Thanksgiving was just like every other day of the year for you.
Exactly. I guess that's what I've just admitted.
Because that sounds like your normal lunch to me. I would be happy with an all-stuffing Thanksgiving, maybe.
Yes, an all-stuffing
if Thanksgiving. If there's a little slice of turkey that I could have with it, but an all-stuffing Thanksgiving with maybe just turkey gravy.
So, Sho, you grew up with the turkey this Thanksgiving. Like, how do you feel about it now? Like, do you feel like turkey has to be part of your Thanksgiving?
I mean, not really. I'm not really that big of a fan of turkey, but I also think that turkeys are kind of gross looking. You know, like the breast is just so big. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's not all turkeys, you know.
Yeah, no, I know. But, like, the one that is most commonly on American tables, it always, like, freaks me out a little bit.
But that, you know, that's it. They breed them to be more and more that way every year because that's what people seem to want.
Yeah, and the heritage turkey that my family got one time was actually very, I was very impressed. I was just,
yeah.
Like, I could eat this. I could eat this on a weeknight, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Something with flavor.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it all had, like, even the breast meat had flavor. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, otherwise, like, right now, you're stuck with the darkest of the dark meat if you want something.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
that.
Thank you so much, Joe. We really appreciate your calling. I hope we've answered your questions.
You did, I guess.
Bye, Joe. How do you feel about meat or oysters in stuffing?
We generally do a sausage stuffing, like a sage sausage stuffing.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Do you believe in oyster stuffings?
That they exist?
Yeah, that you would ever choose to make one.
Yeah, I've had some good oyster stuffings. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, oyster stuffing is funny because it sounds gross if you've never had it, but it doesn't really taste, it doesn't taste like cooked oysters, and it doesn't have that sort of, it doesn't have like the sort of fishiness that you would expect from a seafood stuffing.
Yeah.
It really just tastes sort of really savory and briny and actually quite nice.
It tastes like, to me, it tastes like a baked oyster, like almost like an oyster arrigatoni, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So finally, we have to have what is the dangling chad of Thanksgiving food discussions, which
okay.
is the jellied cranberry sauce versus the whole
cranberries. Where do I fall on
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
where do
you
fall on it first?
I fall on – my wife is really into the cranberry mold.
Uh-huh. With like the lines on the can on
yeah,
it and everything?
Yeah.
My mom is into it.
Ooh, I cannot deal with that. She actually does this really old-fashioned cranberry mold with – gelatin and you know it's something.
Oh, okay, so she actually makes
yeah.
the mold. No, what my mom likes is opening up the can on both ends and then depositing it on a plate, so you get the lines from the inside of the tin can
at the top of the
yeah,
bottom.
Yeah, it's how they served the cranberry sauce like in my middle school and high school cafeteria,
and also in prison. So wait, so that's what that's what your mom does.
We had jellied cranberry sauce growing up. These days, sometimes we had real cranberry sauce too. These days we pretty much do just real cranberry sauce.
So when you do real cranberries, it's like a cranberry conserve with nuts or orange.
I actually like to keep it simple. Like I'll do just cranberries with sugar and maybe a little tiny pinch of salt and then just cook it down until the cranberries
are
burst.
Soft.
Yeah. And they burst and they jelly themselves because they're so high in pectin. You know, sometimes I'll add in maybe like a strip of orange zest or a cinnamon stick or something
like
that.
Yeah, so just a little bit of, that's what I was going to say, a little bit of citrus.
Yeah, but I tend to like it pretty simple. So like simple roasted Brussels sprouts, roasted potatoes, you know, not a lot of, the only place where I do a lot of sort of herbs and other seasonings would be in the stuffing, I guess. You know, most of the stuff I cook on Thanksgiving is pretty simple.
Kenji, thank you so much for doing this call special sauce with us. It's always a pleasure to us, particularly to sit across the table from you.
Right. Instead of across the country.
Instead of across the country. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time. Have a great Thanksgiving. And that's it.